In the middle of our passage this morning, in the book of Habakkuk, God runs through a list of woes that he has against the people of Babylon. Woe to him who piles up for himself what is not his own. Woe to him who builds his house while others lose theirs. Woe to him who builds a town on the back of mistreated laborers. Woe to him who makes his neighbors sin. It's a pretty intense list, but these are really just a sort of setup for the main event. But the final woe that God has against Babylon is much more personal. In chapter 2, verse 18, in Habakkuk. Whoa, thanks, Ali. One of those. There's a good chance I might slip between those all morning. verse 18. What prophet is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies. For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. What good is an idol, God asks? This is a really practical question that God is asking. Like, what can an idol do for you? And I'm making a bit of assumption this morning that because of how many weeks we've been talking about idols, that you hopefully can sort of immediately consider this question in light of maybe one of your go-to idols. And you might think about it, what is that thing? What is it good for? God asks Babylon, what can your idol teach you about life and the world when you were the one who made the thing? And so consider for a second the American dream, right? I mean, in some ways, it's like the classic, prototypical idol for American people, right? People created this vision of the good life, of a successful life. And then having created this vision, we then turn to it, this thing that we created, and we ask it to teach us how we should live and what we should value. Can you see how this sort of works? We create an idol that represents our hopes and our dreams for life, and then that idol consistently reminds us of our hopes and our dreams so that this thing keeps teaching us what we already deeply believe and already know. You could see the way that this plays out in other places. Consider a job or a career. These are things that we create, but that are a necessary part of life. You sort of heard that in Ali's sharing this morning. A necessary part of life that can become a disordered thing in your life. But if we think about this job or career, a shift happens for us where it's no longer just a job, but it becomes an idol. This thing that you've created, that we've created, is now sort of calling the shots so that we're turning to it to tell us how to do our work. And idols, we find again and again, are sort of ruthless masters because soon they're telling us not just how to do our jobs, but telling us how to live our lives. So our jobs, they teach us how to make our jobs the most important thing because we've already made them more important than they really are. Or consider parenting. We make kids, and sure, but a lot of that is out of our hands. But we know that it's possible to turn our kids into idols. And so what do we do with them? We turn to them before they are fully formed and when they're little, and we ask them to teach us what they want. And then we build elaborate lives around our kids on the lie that what they want must be good for them. And of course, they then teach us how to make them the most important, as we already are making them more important than they are. What good is an idol? What can it teach you? God asks. Well, God goes a little bit further as he announces, woe to him whose only help is a thing made of wood or of stone. Woe to you if the only thing you have to turn to is something that you have made. Friends, some of you are sick. Some of the people that we love are sick. Woe to us if the only thing that we have to turn to is the best help that doctors can provide. Now, doctors are super, right? They are great. We have several nurses here in our family, in our church family. The medical profession is good and is noble, but it can become an idol. And we can start pleading with our treatments and pleading with our medicines and our doctors and our procedures to rescue us. We imagine that this thing that we have made with our hands, some medicine, some treatment, can breathe life into us. But God reminds us, idols have no life to give. Medicine and treatment, they can help repair our bodies. This is true. But there is no breath in them. God tells Habakkuk. This is why sometimes doctors do get it wrong. When they look at our bodies and they tell us how long we have to live, they can read our vitals, but they can't begin to say anything about the breath, the spirit, the life that God has put in us. And so some people live far longer than their bodies say that they should, while some people don't live nearly as long as their bodies say that they're capable of. Right? The life-giving breath of God is not in the work of our hands. It is always in God, the life breather. Which is why God says, woe to anyone who trusts in their own creation. So God thinks it's crazy to let our idols teach us. And he also says that we are in a bad place when we are calling on our idols for help. There's one more idea here that's really important to the whole book of Habakkuk. God refers to these things that we've made and that we trust as speechless. In each of these ways, God is setting up idols as a terrible conversation partner. Right? I mean, he paints this picture of humans just jabbering away at these stone and wood creations, talking, asking questions, getting ideas, making decisions. But it is all one-sided. It is all us seeking something from something that can't answer us. Yet we often imagine answers. And this is a pretty incredible ability the human brain has, to imagine answers from an inanimate object. But we know, in many ways from some basic psychology, that the answers we are imagining are exactly the answers that we were hoping to find. Our idols are not alive. They are speechless. They cannot answer us or help us. And so God's final word here then is, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. What does that mean? Well, God suggests, if you're going to carry on a one-sided conversation, it might as well be in the direction that could actually bring you life. The God who created all things with words is eager to speak, and so who is ready to listen? And maybe you know the great story of Martha and Mary in the Gospels. Jesus came into town and Martha was busy preparing home and meal while Mary went straight to sit at Jesus' feet to learn from him. And Martha is frustrated that she's left to do all the work, but Jesus praises Mary. Sorry to all the Marthas in the room. There is a time for our service, for the work of our hands, but the more important thing is that we would sit at the feet of the life giver, that we would listen to him and learn from him. And Mary chooses learning and listening, and she is commended for it. And we see this in another New Testament passage as well. Paul is writing to the Corinthians, a church that's full of Gentile converts, which means these Gentiles would have spent their entire lives worshiping idols in temples. So they would have been used to, in their whole lives, calling out to these idols, asking questions of them, speaking to them without any answer back, or successfully, effectively imagining that they are receiving the answers that they're looking for. But now they have received an answer from God. Paul tells them that they have received an answer from God, the answer from God, that they have heard the good news about Jesus, that they have heard that the God of Israel speaks, and he speaks real words that actually change reality, and that his word even became flesh and dwelt among us. Paul reminds these people that they have heard this word for themselves. They have trusted it, and now they have rejected their speechless idols that cannot answer. And I love Paul's advice for them then. He says, you've spent years calling out, asking questions, praying to idols that have never responded. Now, just listen and learn in silence and submission to the God who speaks. He warns these Gentiles who are just coming into the church about speaking too much, too soon. After years of speaking and learning how to imagine answers, Paul invites them to let God's life-giving word be breathed into them for a while. So that after years of making idols in their own images, Paul is encouraging these people to let God remake them in his image. And so Paul he urges them to listen and to learn about who God is and what God is like. Paul is urging them, encouraging them to listen and learn about the world and God's plans for it. And Paul, he urges them to listen and learn about who they are and what they were made for. And so the question that Paul poses to them in this letter is, will they sit at the feet of their new Lord, Jesus, as Mary did? Or will they go on talking like they've always done? And this really leads us to the heart of Habakkuk. It leads us to God's heart. The prophet Habakkuk shows us how to keep silence before the Lord who speaks. Habakkuk shows us how to keep silence before the Lord, which, if you noticed from our reading this morning, and if you noticed reading through it this week, silence apparently doesn't actually require you to be completely silent. Some of you, like me, are like, yes. The book of Habakkuk opens with questions, a series of questions from Habakkuk. How long? And why? You've asked these questions before, haven't you? How long? And why? I mean, you could fill in the rest of those sentences with any number of things. These are the questions that we ask about our lives and about the world and what this is all about. Why is there suffering? How long will it continue? Habakkuk teaches us to turn these questions toward God. Because God responds. And God has responded. God speaks. In this moment, in this book, he teaches Habakkuk. He says to him, look and see what I am doing, God says. And then he begins to describe what he's doing. But it's funny because God's response really isn't like sufficient for Habakkuk. He's not really like, oh, now that makes perfect sense. Okay, God, thanks for your answer. Because, see, God's response made absolutely no sense to Habakkuk. Have you ever had this experience as you read scripture, as God begins to open you to what he's doing in the world and how and why, and you go, that makes no sense in light of the way that I know the world to be, the way the world works. This is what's happening for Habakkuk. And he immediately begins to sort of stutter out a response. But you, how, why? So he ends up asking the same questions he asked before. And there's new versions of the same question because he was listening before. But Habakkuk's understanding of God just doesn't fit what God is saying. And so Habakkuk, he asks these new versions of his questions, pushing back on God further and deeper. And he says, look, I will keep looking at what God shows me. I will keep considering my own response. Habakkuk seems to at least get that his ways are not yet aligned with God's ways. And so he commits to seeing and hearing what God is doing, what God is saying for himself that he is doing, and sort of testing his own response to that against what God shows him. I hope that you're starting to see the beauty in this book, that it captures a snapshot of a real, living, breathing relationship with a God who listens and speaks, and it goes back and forth. Because many of you have experienced this sort of relationship with God, and for those of you who haven't, Habakkuk suggests that there is this opportunity to meet God and to wrestle with him over his will and what he is doing and who he is. This weekend is kind of a cool weekend, and I'm probably going to embarrass David a little bit, but David and I met a year ago this weekend. He was interviewing for his district license, and he and Eugene had just moved to the States a couple years before. And when David and I met, he was asking a lot of these questions of God. How long, O Lord? Why? If you don't know the story of what they've sort of been through the last few years, let me sort of just tease you by saying you guys should spend some time with them hearing their story. But David has often expressed how much of a blessing our congregation has been in their lives, and I've tried to capture how big of a blessing he has been in my life, because as he has wrestled with these questions, he has modeled for me this willingness to just press into God, to ask, how long, O Lord? I don't know what you're doing, but I trust you and I'll keep walking. And this sort of back and forth where even in the last year, there were moments where it looked like everything was coming together and then the next day everything was falling apart. And sometimes we would meet twice between that and he was in the sort of place of like, it's all happening to, and what God was doing in him, drawing him and Eugene together into this, this powerful, just dynamic relationship was so cool. And this weekend, we got to, I was part of the board that decided to recommend David to our district assembly in May for ordination, which to think about where we were last year, David and Eugene weren't even sure that they were going to get to stay in the States and keep doing ministry here. And now he's being ordained. And it's just, it's really cool. There are living, breathing examples of this type of real relationship with God that Habakkuk gives us a snapshot of, and we see in some of our brothers and sisters here. Habakkuk, in this relationship, asks his questions again and again. And God responds again and again. God begins to address Habakkuk's concerns, but God also acknowledges. He says something that should sort of perk our ears. He says, what I am saying to you is going to be hard to believe. My answer is going to be hard for you to believe. It's going to require Habakkuk to draw close to God and to trust him deeply. And I love that at the end of God's response to Habakkuk, where he says this and sort of gives the details, it's at the end of this response where he says, woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake. Well, what's the significance of that? Well, read in the larger context of Habakkuk, it means that these woes in the middle of this passage, they're not a finger wag, right? They're not God saying, you're so naughty for turning to idols, right? Bad you, shame. No. It's sadder than that. He's saying, you keep asking a wooden thing to wake up and help you, but the maker of heaven and earth is wide awake and he's ready to meet you and walk with you. He's saying, woe to you who could have a real relationship with the creator of all things, but instead you keep turning to the stuff that you have made to rescue you. There's a God who's eager to speak to you, but you keep listening to things that never speak back. There's a God who is hungry to teach you, but you are content to keep relearning the same things over and over. And this is where chapter 2 ends. And chapter 3 begins. And like I said, silence clearly doesn't mean Habakkuk doesn't participate in the conversation. Because chapter 3 is all Habakkuk. It's prayer. It is a response from Habakkuk to God. But it's not just any response. It's a response that shows that Habakkuk has been transformed by God in a significant way through this encounter with God and his holiness and his love. In Habakkuk's head, in his heart, and in his hands, Habakkuk's silence has been filled with God's words, and these have moved him profoundly. And notice what Habakkuk says. So we're in chapter 3, verse 2. Habakkuk says, oh Lord, I have heard the report of you and of your work. I've heard the report of you and of your work. Notice the shift. Habakkuk started earlier in chapter 1 with the work of who? His neighbors all around. All Habakkuk could see was sin and violence and injustice. Habakkuk was glued to his Facebook newsfeed. He was scrolling through Twitter for the most recent update. His favorite news stations were sent to his phone notifications with breaking news, so he got every update about every terrible thing that happened. Habakkuk's attention was on the work of the people. And this sort of attention is bound to give us a certain view of the world. Last week in our small group, we were talking about the violence in our culture. And then someone in our group reminded us that all of the data that we have shows us that over the last 50 years, violent crime has significantly dropped, which most of us sort of instinctively go, how could that possibly be? Because we hear about way more violence today than we did previously. But if we're glued to our news feeds, it's hard to imagine a different truth. And the very next day, after our small group, I was talking with a friend of mine who's not a Christian, who told me that he had just made this commitment to limit his access to both Facebook, Twitter, and the news because he had this sense that it was shaping his view of the world in an unhealthy way. Habakkuk is shifting his view from the work of people to the Lord's work. Which is not to say that Habakkuk now no longer pays attention to anything that's happening, but it's no longer his orientation. Habakkuk's understanding of God is also beginning to narrow and gain greater clarity and definition. So earlier in the book, we hear Habakkuk say to God, "You have eyes so pure that they cannot see evil or look at wrong." Like, that sounds like a great thing to say about God. But like, that sounds like a really great way to honor the Lord, to recognize God is pure and holy. And of course, God, you are so pure and holy that you can't possibly look at evil or see wrong. But what if this is a distorted view of God? See, Habakkuk can't understand what God is doing because he doesn't understand God. See, it seems that Habakkuk has some sense of God's holiness. And that his definition of holiness is like that God is so completely removed from, disconnected from sin and sinners. That maybe God cannot deal with sinners or face sinners or use sinners. And see, the problem with that is that God is telling Habakkuk that his like primary thing that he's doing is to use a group of sinners to accomplish his purpose. And so Habakkuk's head is like, he can't make sense of this. But then here in chapter 3, Habakkuk not only accepts that God will use sinners, but as the prayer goes on, it's fascinating the way that he combines the details of all of these different stories from the First Testament. And he uses them all, he draws them all together to sort of acknowledge all of the different ways that God has, from the very beginning, worked for sinners and worked with sinners and worked through sinners and worked against sinners. That God is not disconnected from them. He is like right in the middle of them. That God's not his holiness is not somehow this obsession with purity in order to be apart from, but his holiness longs to enter into and transform. And so a question is, what's happened to Habakkuk in this conversation with the Lord? Well, we've already sort of hit a couple of these things. He's allowed God to shift his attention. He has allowed God to transform his understanding. And he even allows God to transform his desire. Habakkuk is no longer looking for justice on his own terms, but he wants the kind of justice that truly saves. Habakkuk's sense of time has been shifted in this conversation. right? I mean, you get the sense early on that it starts with hurry. God, do something quick. You're not acting soon enough. To all of a sudden, he's saying, I will quietly wait. But above all this, Habakkuk's loyalties have changed. His loyalties have changed. If you reread his earlier comments, you discover that Habakkuk is a slave to fear. He is a slave to what he can see and what he can touch, to his own understanding. But by the end, his allegiance has shifted. He believed in God at the beginning, right? He's turning to God. He's praying. But now he is choosing to trust him and to follow and to wait. I mean, where he feared the wickedness around him in chapter 3, he says, your work, O Lord, do I fear? When he couldn't see God's salvation at the beginning, his fear caused him to cry out, will you not save? But now he says, I will rejoice in the Lord. I take joy in the God of my salvation. God is my strength. Right? And the key to all of this is how he frames it. His entire view of the world and of God's relationship with it has changed, because in verse 17, he says, chapter 3, verse 17, he says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord is my strength. And he's saying, if everything around me fails, if everything in the world falls apart, everything that I have loved, that I have longed for, that I have looked for, if all of it goes away, I will rejoice in the Lord. This is the choice. This is the response. This is the entry he makes into the life of God after wrestling deeply with his heavenly Father. I want to create some space for a few minutes here for us to talk a little bit. And so we're going to break up into some sort of smaller groups to do this. But in light of this message, I want to ask a question. How is Jesus the fulfillment of, I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you? How is Jesus the answer to God saying, I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you? Right? I mean, it would be easy for me to just say, what is the work that God is doing in our days that you would not believe if I told you? And the Sunday school answer would be Jesus. But now we get to press into that and ask and discuss together, how is Jesus the fulfillment of that? What does it mean to say? What is it that is unbelievable about the truth of Jesus, about what he has come to do? And as you guys are talking about that, the question I would love to ask you as a follow-up is, so have you heard and responded to and rejoiced in the report of this work, this impossible to believe work that God has done in and through Jesus? So let's discuss, and that's all I have. All right, let's start to finish up our conversations. So I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you. God has said, I am drawing all people to myself. Behold, I am making all things new. I mean, and there's some sense in which if we've been in church for any amount of time, we hear that and we go, yeah, I believe that. But these are pretty audacious claims. Behold, I am drawing all people to myself. I am making all things new. So what does it mean for us to say that Jesus is the fulfillment of this? I would love to hear any groups, if you've got some insight you want to share. David's going to run around with the mic for us. So in that same letter from Paul that I mentioned earlier to the Corinthians, he says, Jews demand a sign and Greeks demand wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly, foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. I said that the work that God is doing in our days is drawing all people to himself and making all things new. And Paul says that is happening through the crucifixion of Jesus. That the cross of Christ is doing those things, is accomplishing those things. Like, what does that mean, right? I mean, this, and Whitney, thank you for sharing sort of what your group is wrestling with in terms of how this makes no sense. It is not a sign in any sort of attractive way to see your leader hanging on a cross. And it makes no sort of worldly wisdom to say that it is through self-giving, self-emptying love that enemies are welcomed and received and transformed. But this is the very heart, not only of our faith, but our lives together and of what God is doing in the world. And that is why every single week we come to the table. That is the story that we need to figure out how to keep coming back to. So every time we ask how long, O Lord, questions and why, the table doesn't give us an easy answer by any means. But Paul says in 1 Corinthians, every time we eat the bread and we drink the cup, we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. And so there is this word of hope that as long as it may be, God is at work. And so we continue to wait. And that waiting clearly requires action, and it is a call to live as a particular people in the world who keep sort of representing and showing the world what this crucified Jesus looks like. But this is who we are. This is what God has done. And so let us continue to hear the report, the work that he has done through Christ, and proclaim it. Our kids are going to come in, and we are going to share in this incredible celebration of the work that God has done. So.